Okay, well, thanks, David. Okay, so well, I'd like to tell you a little bit about some things which have been going on in Santa Barbara, I guess, involving a number of students, Courtney Lannett, Rob Sedgwick, the ITB postdoc Center, who has actually just recently moved to MIT, and also been involved with a number of faculty members, Leon Bounds, Doug Scalpino, and Bob Sugar. And we've been trying to understand, basically, strongly interacting electron systems in which one has an exotic ground state such that the low-energy excitations look like particles, but those particle-like excitations carry fractional quantum numbers which are some fractions of that of the electron. But let me just back off a little bit and just put things into perspective. Okay, so the general area that we're working in is, of course, condensed matter physics on the hard or quantum end of condensed matter physics. And in some sense, hard condensed matter physics shares aspects of particle theory and of the bioinformatics program. As in particle physics, we're interested in strongly interacting quantum systems described by quantum field theory, not by string theory, at least we don't think. And like the bioinformatics program, we're really interested in emergent phenomena. We're really interested in situations in which the whole is larger than the sum of the parts. And in particular, then, in hard condensed matter physics, we're interested in the physics of electrons, typically a macroscopic number, 10 to the 23 electrons, moving around in a solid. And since the electronic energy scales are so high, typically on the scales of an electron volt, even at room temperature, one is dealing with low-energy phenomena. So because of that, we typically focus on trying to understand first the ground state of the system of interacting electrons, and then look at what one might call low-energy excitations about the ground state. And those are the excitations which will be thermally excited, let's say even at room temperature, which once again is a low energy on electronic energy scales. Now, it turns out that the electron is, of course, the fundamental building block that we use to understand solids. But perhaps surprisingly, the low-energy quasi-particle excitations around the strongly interacting ground states behave like weakly dressed electrons. That is, one has often the situation where there are electron-like quasiparticles which carry the same quantum numbers as the electron, and essentially move as if they were almost a bare electron, just slightly dressed by the interactions with the other electrons. And that's really what underlies what I call the Fermi-liquid paradigm, which has worked so successfully in understanding many different types of solids, metals, insulators, and semiconductors. But what I want to tell you a little bit about is a goal to try to move beyond the Fermi-liquid paradigm and address materials which don't seem to fit so nicely into this standard picture. So in particular, what we're going to be after is trying to understand strongly interacting electron systems which have exotic ground states, which once again support low-energy excitations which look like particles, but we're interested in the cases where those particles carry quantum numbers which are some fraction of that of the electron. And the case which is perhaps of most interest phenomenologically is something called spin charge separation, in which the low energy excitations are not electron-like, but consist of two fragments with quantum numbers which add up to that of the electron. So there's a spin a half charge zero fermion and a spin zero charge E boson. This is often called a spin-on. This is called a charge-on or hole-on. And so what we're going to, in fact, be interested in is strongly interacting, as I say, electron at ground states in which the low-energy excitations are fragments of the electron, the spin-on and the charge-on, which together have quantum numbers which coincide with that of the bare electron. Now, trying to do this is challenging, really, on two fronts. Experimentally, it turns out it's very, very difficult to tell whether or not the system one's looking at, the particular solid piece of material one's looking at, is actually exhibiting fractionalization. It turns out also it's challenging theoretically, and Perhaps it's amusing just to make an analogy with what particle physicists did in the context of the strong interactions. I mean, in that case, so in quantum chromodynamics, the fundamental particles are, of course, the quarks. And one has the gauge bosons, the gluons. And as we learned, what, some 30 years ago, I guess, at low energies and long length scales, the gluons can, in fact, glue together quarks, can confine the quarks into baryons, the hadrons, mesons, protons, neutrons, and so forth. Okay, well, what we're trying to do is start over here, in fact, with electrons, which are, of course, our fundamental particles, the building blocks we use in condensed matter physics. And we're trying to, in some sense, go in this direction and deconfine or split the electron into constituents, and these constituents are the spin-on and charge-on, these two particles over here. The spin-ons and charge-ons are in some sense going to play the roles of the quarks, but they're not going to be the fundamental degrees of freedom that we're using to describe the original theory. It turns out there's also something that plays the role of the gluons, or a gauge field, and that gauge field supports in two dimensions particle-like excitations or vortex-like excitations, which we call visons. So the visons, it turns out, are going to play a very important role in understanding this process of fractionalization, understanding this process of splitting the electron into two different particle fragments.
Just to make sure. Two dimensions.
Yeah. So we're going to be predominantly interested in two plus one dimensions, but we're also interested in 3+1 dimensions. I'll focus on 2+1.
The vison is like the
gluon or like the monopole? Yeah, the vison is going to be, I guess it's like the monopole. It's going to be a flux in the gauge field. It's sort of the magnetic field associated with the gauge field.
Looking at this analogy, of course, if you go to higher energies, that's where you discover in QCD the quarks and gluons. In what sense?
Well, when we go to higher energies, we discover the baryelectrons, right? Certainly inside the atoms, right, okay. You know, the electrons. It's really at low energies and long length scales that we have new particles.
Right.
And when we look at high energies, we find the electron. So, in fact, if one were, you know, living in a universe at low energies in this fractionalized phase, we would think, okay, we have these particles, spin-ons and charge-ons, right, which would actually, you know, be ancestors of a more fundamental particle at high energies, namely the electron, right? So what I want to do is first just briefly remind you of the Fermi liquid paradigm, which I've already mentioned, is basically the paradigm which works so well in hard condensed matter physics, in which one doesn't have something exotic like spinning an electron going on, but rather the quasiparticle excitations in the interacting system look like essentially a bare electron. And then I'll turn to this phenomenon of splitting the electron, that is fractionalization. And I guess I've already told you, at least in a nutshell, what it is. I'll tell you why we might be interested in it. Then I'll tell you at least how we can get a understanding theoretically of how one could achieve this. I'll talk a little bit about how one might detect it. And the last is the hardest one to address. Now, when does it actually occur? And I'll leave that to the end. Okay, so the Fermi liquid paradigm. I'm using a weak chalk here. We're also trying to understand electrons moving around in solids. Typically, one focuses on the electrons which are in the outer shells of the atoms. Those are the ones that are mobile and can move between different atoms. And one basically treats the nucleus of the atoms and the inner core shell electrons, usually, as a potential that the outer shell electrons see. So if we then focus on those outer shell electrons, we have a Hamiltonian, which basically consists of three terms, a kinetic energy term, here m is the mass of the electron, a potential energy term, which describes then the interaction of the outer shell electrons with the core electrons and the nucleus, and then a term which describes the Coulomb interaction, the Wondervar static Coulomb interaction between the outer shell electrons. And in some sense, the history of solid state physics has started from this term in Hamiltonian, moved towards and included this term in Hamiltonian, and then, I mean, now we're really focusing on this term, I think, in the 21st century. Okay, what do I mean? Well, as you mostly know, if we just consider the first term of the Hamiltonian, we just have the kinetic energy of free electrons, and as Sommerfeld taught us, we can just take a plane wave single particle orbitals, if you will, single particle states, which carry an energy, just the kinetic energy of that electron, h bar squared k squared over 2m, and we just fill up energy levels just as one does in an atom. Here, though, in order to minimize the kinetic energy, we want to try to put the energy electrons in at the lowest possible kinetic energies, that is, near zero momentum. So in the usual k-space picture, if I were in two dimensions, one basically starts putting in filling in low energy electron states, and eventually one has used up all the electrons that one has in the system, and the highest energy electron is called the Fermi energy. It's typically 5 to 10 electron volts. And this then, this field Fermi C, is the ground state of this first term in the Hamiltonian, okay? And we're really interested in not just the ground state, but I said the low energy excitations. Well, the low energy excitations in this for this first term of the Hamiltonian are very simple. We just take an electron in one of the field states below the Fermi energy, and we promote it and create an electron above the Fermi C. So this is called an electron hole excitation. And of course, for this first term of the Hamiltonian, these are exact eigenstates. So these are, in fact, infinitely long-lived excitations. If you add an electron here, it will just live there forever. And it's really these low-energy particle Hall excitations which dominate and determine the thermodynamic and transport properties of metals, like copper or niobium or tin. The second term in the Hamiltonian is the periodic potential from the underlying ions. If we assume that there's a perfect crystal, we don't have translational invariance anymore, but we have a discrete translational invariance. And because of that, the plane waves are no longer eigenstates, but one has block states. And as you know, block states are such that one has ranges of energy in which there are forbidden states. So if this is energy, single particle energy levels, there's typically a forbidden region or forbidden regions that can be filled bands. So for example, in a semiconductor, one would have a filled valence band of electron states. There'd be a band gap, and then one would have an empty set of states up here, which is called the conduction band. Okay, and the difference between a semiconductor and an insulator is the size of the gap. In semiconductors, the gap is not as big as in insulators. In the presence of these two terms in the Hamiltonian, we can consider excited states above the ground state. We can take an electron from, let's say, the filled valence band and promote it above the gap to into the conduction band. Once again, this is an exact eigenstate. There's an infinitely long-lived electron excitation and a hole excitation. And of course, these are the electrons and holes, which are so important in the way semiconductor devices work. Okay, but in both these situations, the situation which is a caricature for a metal and the situation which is a caricature for an insulator and a semiconductor, these plenipotential excitations are, in fact, eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. But things change, of course, when we include the Coulomb interactions between the electrons, right? Then these are no longer eigenstates of the full Hamiltonian. And you know, that's when, basically, we're dealing really with a many-body problem. We have to trying to understand the physics of you know, 10 to the 23 interacting electrons. We can't get away, at least naively, with ignoring the interactions between the electrons. And so, in particular, the most important thing that occurs, let me just draw the Fermi C in the case of a metal here, where we have, let's say, an electron and maybe a hole over here. Once we turn on the interactions between the electrons, clearly this electron can lose some energy and create a particle hole pair, right? It can cascade down an energy and create an excitation. Now, in Feynman diagram language, I guess this would look something like this. Right, the electron's coming along, it interacts with another electron, it scatters, lowers its energy, and excites an electron hole pair. Okay, and so it's because of this, these electron states, in fact, decay. These single particle eigenstates decay. Okay. But what's important, and this is really what why the Fermi liquid paradigm works when it does, is that there's a rather limited phase space for these scattering events. Due to the Pauli exclusion principle, the phase space for these scattering events in particular gets small when the energy, let me call the energy of the electron above the Fermi energy epsilon, when that energy gets small, it becomes very hard to, in fact, scatter that electron off other electrons. And it turns out that if one treats the Coulomb interaction perturbatively as a perturbation, even though it's actually not weak, but if one treats it as a perturbation, one can calculate the decay rate, and one finds that at least in three dimensions, and in two dimensions, essentially, one has the decay rate varies with the square of the energy of the electron excitation. So in particular, in the limit that the energy of the excitation gets very small, the decay rate, which you should think of as the width of the particle, gets very much narrower than the energy of the particle itself. Okay, here all the energies are measured with respect to the Fermi energy. So in particular, in the limit that the energy of this particle goes to zero, the rate goes to zero, and the lifetime goes to infinity. Okay, so this particle becomes infinitely long-lived, even though one has an interacting electron system. And these are the Landau quasi-particle excitations, which are essentially electron-like. They have all the same quantum numbers as the electron. Okay, and this is really what underlies Fermi liquid, a theory. And let me just reiterate that point by saying, you know, really the defining characteristic then of a Fermi liquid is that one has electron-like quasi-particles. Okay, what do I mean electron-like? Well, I mean two things. I mean the quantum numbers are the same as bare electron quantum numbers. Right, so that's the charge is E, the spin is a half. In a translationally invariant system, you could label these quasi-particle states by momentum K. But, in fact, we require more than that. What we require is that the quasi-particle excitations, in some sense, have a finite overlap with a bare electron excited state. What do I mean? If we take the ground state of the full interacting electron system, which in general we don't know, let me just denote it here as the ground state, we can ask, we can create basically an excited state by adding an electron at momentum k. Here I'll take k bigger than the Fermi wave vector. So I'm adding an electron outside of the Fermi C. When I do this, when I act on the exact interacting ground state with this operator, I clearly add an electron, but I don't go into an eigenstate of the full interacting electron system. But what's in, one has to ask is, does one have a finite overlap with the exact eigenstates of the interacting electron system? So let me denote this with a little n as the a set of exact eigenstates of the interacting electron system with n plus 1 particles in it. And really, in Fermi liquid theory, one wants this overlap, and is the overlap of the actual quasi-particle excitation with the bare electron to be non-zero. To be a little more precise, what one should actually, what one typically wants to do is to define an electron spectral function that is to perform a sum over all possible excited states. And a lot of these excited states, for example, won't have the right momentum, so then there's going to be zero overlap in any case. But if we perform a sum of all excited states of the n plus one particle system, and it's often useful also to energy resolve by putting in a delta function. So essentially, this is really looking at what is the overlap of a state which is in which one adds a bare electron to the full interacting problem at momentum k, increasing the energy by an amount omega. How much overlap does that have with the full interacting excited states? Okay, so this is the electron spectral function, and let me see, I guess I'll just... And I guess, okay, so the key point here is that if I compute the electron spectral function in the case, which I just erased, of no interactions between the electrons, this is just a delta function of omega minus e k squared over 2m. I mean, typically one subtracts off the Fermi energy here. So it's a delta function telling us there's an infinitely long-lived particle excitation at momentum k and energy omega. But when I turn the interactions and I go into a Fermi liquid, what one has is a weight in front of this delta function z, which has to be bigger than zero, but I guess will generically be smaller than unity, and then there'll be some background smooth part. Let me just write smooth background part to this electron spectral function. Okay, so it's really this quasi, what's called a quasi-particle pole z, which being non-zero is what signifies that one's dealing with a system in which the Lorentz quasi-particle excitations not only have the quantum numbers of the electron, but have a finite overlap with the bare electron eigenstates. And we understand, as I say, simple metals, semiconductors, insulators, and many, many different materials working under the assumption, effectively, that z is non-zero.
Can I just understand this in terms of something I'm a little more familiar with? Consider the two-point function for these quasi particles is a Green's function.
Yeah.
It has a pole with a...
So this is the imaginary part of the Green's function Fourier transformed. In space-time into momentum and energy, exactly.
So the pole doesn't have strength unity.
The pole doesn't have strength unity, but it's still... Okay, actually, I should say there's one thing I did wrong here, probably everyone's noticed. In the interacting system, in order to have an infinitely long-lived particle, which is true, when one has a delta function, one actually has to take the Fermi wave vector and bring it down to the Fermi surface. But otherwise, it will decay. So I... Sorry about that. That's... one really wants to, in fact, this then is zero, because one's living right on the Fermi surface. So if one moves a little bit away from the Fermi surface, this delta function gets broadened, and the particle does decay and has a width. But in the limit that the energy, the momentum of that excitation approaches the Fermi momentum, the lifetime of that excitation goes to infinity, and one has this delta function. Okay, well, so the reason this defining this electron spectral function is nice is that it not only really is the defining characteristic of a Fermi liquid, z being non-zero, it's going to enable us, in principle, to distinguish between Fermi liquids and more exotic states in which the particle excitations about the ground state are fractionalized. In those instances, z is identically zero. So it's a nice quantity to be thinking about. The other reason it's nice to be looking at this electron spectral function is that one can measure it in angle-resolved photo emission spectroscopy. So as we understood from Einstein, and one sends in a high-energy photon into a solid, if it's high enough energy, one will kick out an electron. Well, it turns out by measuring the energy and momentum distribution of the emitted electron when one sends in a high-energy photon, high energy here being maybe 40 electron volts or something. Is that right?
20, 30.
That one can back out under some assumptions, which are sometimes quite reasonable, particularly when the photon has very high energy, like it does. That one can basically back out the electron spectral function. Okay, so let me now move on to fractionalization. What I've given you so far is basically sort of in a nutshell the quantum theory of solids. Let me mention then that really in the last 10 or 15 years there's been a lot of attention focused on materials. Okay, we call them normal materials. They often involve many atoms, but materials in which don't fit into the standard paradigms of Fermi liquid theory. And when we try to understand those materials, we say what we're doing is non-Fermi liquid theory. We're trying to understand non-Fermi liquids. But it's not generally good to define something as what it isn't. So, so different people, differ in opinions as to what a non-Fermi liquid is. What I guess I want to tell you a little bit about is a particular non-Fermi liquid in which the electron actually decays into fragments which behave as independent particles, and that's a fractionalized phase. There's various bits of suggestive evidence that perhaps something like fractionalization is going on in a number of different experimental systems. Perhaps the best studied and one has captured the most interest are the high-temperature superconductors, which are sort of the quintessential non-Fermi liquid. They really don't fit at all well into the standard solid-state theory paradigm. And moreover, and I just want to show you one bit of data. Am I allowed to use the overhead CRI, maybe? Many of you have seen this. Let me see if I just turn. Just in a nutshell, what this is some data taken on a high-temperature superconductor. Let me just very quickly, because we're not going to be able to see it. But just remind you that these high-temperature superconductors have a phase diagram where we vary a doping concentration X. We vary the concentration of some particular atom. Have this, rather famous phase diagram. One has a superconducting state here, which temperatures go as high as 160 Kelvin, and one has over here some sort of anti-ferminetic insulators. And in this region here, which is called the underdoped region, because one hasn't doped it quite enough to get the maximum TC, a lot of strange stuff is going on, which we don't understand. So we put a big question mark there. This data, is essentially, a measurement of the ARPIS. So I'm looking at essentially the electron spectral function as a function of energy, and what one has, five different samples corresponding to different values of X, basically, going from a sample which is near optimal doping to a sample which is very underdoped. And what one sees is, in fact, what look like sharp quasi-particle peaks, particularly in these two samples, something really sticking out of the background. But the crucial thing to note is that these sharp quasi-particle peaks only occur when one actually cools the material into the superconducting phase. When one goes above the superconducting transition temperature, so one's in this pseudo-gap regime, that sharp spectral feature is completely absent. Okay, and so this is suggested, perhaps, that, it certainly suggests that it's hard to find a good electron-like quasiparticle excitation in this pseudo-gap phase. And put it another way, it's a very broad feature, very, very broad, which suggests that the electron is, in fact, decaying, and one possibility is that it can be decaying into independent constituent particles, and that's what I want to tell you a little bit about in the remaining time. Okay, so this. Because let me come back to this outline. Got to go through those points. Okay, I think I've told you what fractionalization is. And let me just put it up here once again, just because I find this useful. It's a situation where the Lorentz excitations then have quantum numbers which are not the same as the electron. Now, let me address this question. Why bother? Why are we interested in fractionalized phases? Well, I mean, we're interested in part just because if they exist, it's a novel phase which we don't really understand all that well, and which we'd like to see what actually occurs in nature. But there's another reason in the context of the high-temperature superconductors which is really tantalizing, which is that a fractionalized phase gives us, in fact, a non-pairing route into a superconductor. What do I mean? Well, to get a superconductor, one has to condense a boson. That boson has to carry electric charge in order to get zero resistance. In a conventional BCS theory, which works so well in low-temperature superconductors, above TC, one has a phase, let's say niobium, which is well described as a Fermi liquid. We believe there are well-defined quasi-particle excitations, which essentially look like electrons. And these two electrons then are weakly paired together with an attractive interaction, which is believed to come from phonons. And so one has a Cooper pair with electrical charge twice that of the electron, and this Cooper pair condenses, and that gives one a superconducting state. And in this superconducting state, in fact, there is sometimes what's cited as direct evidence for the fact that there's a pair of electrons which is condensing is flux quantization in a superconductor. The magnetic flux is quantized. And in a conventional superconductor, actually also in the high-temperature superconductors, the flux is quantized in units of the fundamental flux quantum in which the Cooper pair charge enters rather than the single electron charge. Okay, so this is the route that we understand of how to get into a superconductor from a conventional metal that we understand, well, basically a Fermi liquid. But if we had sitting over here a fractionalized phase, for example, a fractionalized insulator, we might, where we have these fragments of the electron as excitations, if we can somehow change things so that this boson, which carries the charge of the electron, becomes mobile, we can condense directly this charge E particle. So charge E condensation. And in particular, you might make it mobile by doping charge carriers into the system. And so that's the thoughts in the context of the cuprates. And since we're condensing a charge E particle, we know we're going to go into a superconductor. And what the surprising thing is that, in fact, we go into the same superconducting state.
Same
minimum flux? Yeah, that's the puzzle. At least one of the puzzles is how can you go into a superconducting state with H over 2 flux quantization when you're a charge E condensate, right? So I'll address that in a few minutes. What one essentially has here then is a route into a superconducting state in which there's no notion of pairing of electrons. In fact, rather than pairing the electrons, the way one should think about this perhaps is that the electron, which has a charge E and Fermi statistics, is losing its Fermi statistics to the spin-carrying excitation, leaving behind the charge of the electron, but with a Bose particle. And then one can just condense, essentially, a charge E particle. So this is as close as one can get, basically, to condensing directly the electron. The electron, of course, being a fermion, one cannot pose condense it. So, in fact, let me address this question.
Sorry, can I just
ask? Yeah, sure.
What are the rules of the game in fractionation? Because, for example, could it...
No rules, yeah.
Could it be that one of the degrees of freedom, which is a fermion, has charge minus one, and the boson has charge two?
Yep. You could imagine that.
And in that case, you'd say, okay, the Fluchtwander comes out right.
Yeah, well, okay, but you have to be careful. I think if you actually construct a situation like that, the flux quantum might come out right, but you would actually end up with... My guess, you'd end up with excitations in the superconductor, funny vortex-like excitations, which one doesn't have in a conventional superconductor. So, in a conventional superconductor, there are two types of excitations above the ground state. There are vortex excitations in two dimensions, one has vortices, and vortices are, you know, singular points around which one has circulating currents, such that when one takes a Cooper pair around the vortex, one picks up a 2 pi of phase. The other excitation in a superconductor, besides the vortices, are the quasi-particle excitations, which basically involve breaking apart a pair, and so sort of single electrons, if you will. And those are the sort of the universal properties, you know, generic and universal properties of a superconducting phase. You know, it has to be a phase in which has these two types of excitations, and that's it. Okay, and my guess is if one starts doing things which are more exotic even still, under many circumstances, one ends up going into a superconductor which is not a conventional superconductor. But the rules are fluid, you know. We're groping around, we're trying to understand, you know, what might be going on in some of these materials. And some of this, you know, this approach is motivated, well, I mean, a lot of it's motivated by experiments or sort of theoretical reasonings. And,
in some
versions,
isn't there another
U1
that binds the constituent A and the other together? The fact that the inversion is another
U1. Yeah, well, okay, so...
And so if B condenses,
so
these
numbers
broken U1.
Okay, well, in this version, there's a Z2.
Just a Z2.
Yeah, and when the B condenses, the B carries a Z2 charge.
Okay, but it's electromagnetic.
Okay, I can't speak for his theory. I mean, I don't want to go there right here. I think it's not going to be a... so basically the resolution of how you get a flux quantum, which is HC over 2E, is that in addition to the, is the following. In the fractionalized phase, in addition to the fragments of the electron, the charge on and the spin on, there's also this vortex-like excitation, which I called a vison, okay? And the property of a vison is such that when you take the charge E boson around it, the boson wave function changes sign. So one should think of basically having a branch cut leaving this vison.
The vison is
the
Z2 vortex.
It's a Z2 vortex, yeah. Vison is a Z2 vortex. Two visons are the same as no vison, right? Because it wouldn't pick up anything. Or the two strings would cancel. And B and F carry Z2 charge. B, of course, also carries electromagnetic charge, and F carries, you know, spin, you know, physical spin. And so what happens is, if one is in a fractionalized insulator, the vison is in fact an excitation, but it's an excitation which costs a finite amount of energy. But one can nonetheless provide that energy and put a vison into the system, and then ask, in the presence of a vison, what happens when one condenses or tries to condense a charge E boson? Right, so one's condensing basically a charge E boson, which, as it goes around the singularity, has antiperiodic boundary conditions. And in order for that to be compatible with a condensation, the boson phase has to wind by pi, or or minus pi gradually as it goes around in order to essentially counteract this string. And so what happens is then when we have a vison and we condense this chargy boson, the one this vison basically turns into an HC over 2E vortex. HC over 2E because the charge E boson winds by pi, winds by half of what it what a charge 2E particle would wind by. And that HC over 2E a vortex can in fact have circulation that goes this way or circulation that goes the other way.
Right? Are you going to say more about why there are such excitations?
Yeah, well, no, I guess I will in a few minutes, yeah.
But is there an unbroken Z2 gauge symmetry or not?
There's an unbroken Z2 gauge symmetry here.
No, but it's broken by the condensate.
But it's broken by the condensate. Yeah. Because B carries a Z2 charge.
Where did it come from? It looks, you set it up as a puzzle.
Yeah, okay, so let me tell you where it comes from. I mean, there's different ways to try to understand why it would be there. But I think I will, okay, let me just turn directly to that. I do want to just say one thing before I return to that, is that, I mean, the essence of a superconductor is the Meissner effect, that the magnetic field is expelled. When you expel magnetic field, you're expelling flux, and you equivalently are expelling vortices. So superconductors don't like vortices. They push the vortices out. The essence of a fractionalized insulator is that they don't like visons, that the visons get pushed out. Okay. And then it's really that's a crucial observation, which suggests ways in which one might try to measure the vison. No, actually, they wouldn't. They wouldn't. They don't exclude magnetic flux at all. In an insulator, you can have magnetic flux penetrating to the sample.
In the superconductor?
In the superconductor.
Oh, like the
B. Yeah, no, once you're in the superconductor, and the superconductor is a superconductor in the superconductor, yeah, so
the. So the thing is, there's an extra Z2 gauge symmetry.
Well, okay, I don't like gauge theories, actually. What's that? Well, I don't. I can do the. Well, okay, I like pairing particles better than splitting them in half, okay? So what I'm going to do is try to understand how you can split a particle in half by pairing something else, okay? And, in fact, we've just seen it. We've just seen it because in a superconductor, you pair two electrons, and you halve the flux quantum, HC over 2E. So when you pair particles, you halve the vorticity. To halve a particle, you want to pair vortices, right? So I want to consider what happens when we pair vortices. To make things simple, let me just take a system of two-dimensional bosons. We can think of these bosons, actually, I'll just go straight to the cut to the chase. I mean, basically, consider these bosons. I want to consider a charged 2E boson which doesn't carry any spin. And I can create it like this. Okay, it has the quantum numbers of a Cooper pair. This doesn't mean that I'm in a superconductor. It's just this is an operator which adds charge 2 and no spin. And it has Bose statistics. Two of these things commute with one another. Okay, and so as we've seen, basically whenever one, in two dimensions, when one has a system of bosons, one can consider, and one goes into, let's say, a superconductor, one consider these excitations, which are these vortex excitations. And in two dimensions, vortices are particles. So one has a sort of a dual description here of two-dimensional bosons. There's a sort of a boson or particle vortex duality. That is, one can think of, describing the system in terms of the bosons, or if one wishes, one can describe the system in terms of the vortices, where the vortices are the particle excitations. And things are reciprocal, that is, the quantization of the vorticity comes from the requirement that the that the wave function for this Cooper pair is single valued, that it winds by 2 pi. Right? That's why classical vortices are not quantized. Quantum vortices are quantized because the charged particle's wave function has to be single valued. Likewise, you can think of the quantization of the charge as coming from the requirement that when you take a vortex around the charge, that the vortex wave function has to be single valued and has to pick up a 2 pi. So one has these two ways of thinking about two-dimensional systems. And in fact, one of the things that a number of us have been trying to do over the last 3 or 4 years is to try to understand strongly interacting electron systems and phases in terms of vortex variables. Okay, so that's... and it turns out some things are simple to think about in terms of those variables. Yes?
So this sounds a lot like electromagnetic
duality. Yeah, it is. It's a 2 plus 1. Yeah, sure.
But there, I guess we believe some theories are self-dual, and you have an equivalent description in terms of magnetic variables, and other theories are not. You have an equivalent
description of
some other theories.
This is, I didn't say self-dual.
So you're assuming this is self-dual?
No, no, I'm not. It's not self-dual.
It's not self-dual.
I mean, if I take a model of bosons with a short-range interaction, just I end up with a description of vortices which, in fact, have a long-range logarithmic interaction, and it's a retarded interaction to boot. So it actually, one ends up with vortices interacting with a dynamical gauge field, which looks like 2 plus 1 dimensional scalar quantum electrodynamics, and I guess that's, right. So one goes from a U1 global symmetry theory to a U1 gauge theory. But I'm not going to, and then it's not self-dual, but one can pass to these dual variables, if you will. I guess that's what I'm saying. So basically, if one imagines we want to do the dual version of BCS theory, right? It's around when pairing particles. Oh, let me just say one thing first. When we have... the fact that when we have bosons and vortices, that each determines the quantization of the others gives us an identity between the boson and vortex charge. I guess this is the same as the electromagnetic charges. This is Dirac, okay. Dirac, I don't know who in 2 plus 1, maybe that was baby Dirac or something. I don't know. Maybe there's even some...
Dirac pi.
Okay, yeah, no, it is. exactly. So that's good. So in order to... halve the boson charge, what we want to do is consider a vortex excitation, which is built from a pair of the basic HC over 2E vortices. So we basically want to take an HC over 2E vortex, we want to add it to another HC over 2E vortex, we want to pair these, that gives us an HC over E vortex, okay? And then we want to, in fact, condense this vortex composite. Just like in a superconductor, one pairs electrons and one condenses the Cooper pair composite. And so this leads, though, rather than to a superconductor, because we're condensing not particles but vortices, it leads, in fact, to an insulator, something which doesn't electrically conduct at all.
So what you're saying is more than that. You're saying that there can't be single vortex excitations. They all have to be bound into pairs.
Yeah, exactly. You can create them above a gap.
The single?
Yes, if you pay energy, but in the ground state, there are none.
What's the statistics of the vortex?
The vortices are bosons.
What about vortices of opposite flux?
Okay, so the vortices are relativistic bosons, the vortices and anti-vortices. A vortex and an anti-vortex can annihilate and give you nothing, so you can't condense that object. So I'm condensing, if phi is a relativistic field which creates vortices. I mean, if you want to think about it, I'm condensing, I'm binding two positive circulation vortices and condensing those, and I'm also binding two negative circulation vortices and condensing those.
The dual of superconductor, which is what you're describing, is the confining thing. You're saying insulator is an electric, it's confining electric charge?
No, it doesn't. Well, it may well be because we've got actually a non-compact gauge theory. Yeah. Actually, I'm not sure what the answer is. I mean, I guess the Higgs is the same as the confining, but that's where you have a compact gauge theory, right? This, if you actually follow this through, this this is a U1. It's a non-compact gauge theory.
So,
okay. Well, how do you get confinement with a non-compact gauge theory? I don't know.
Just in the sense that
condense, and so you have.
If I cut an electron, it's all about the electric
flux.
Yeah, no, so it gives, there is an energy gap in an insulator for creating electron hole pairs. But it doesn't cost energy which grows linearly with their separation. There's just an energy gap and you can pull them apart.
But what is the energy?
The energy gap is just something which is set by the strength of the condensate of the vortices, but it's something which is intensive. I don't know, can someone else give a better answer to this?
Don't you have an electric Meissner thing?
Yeah. Why not?
If you took a region of rectangular region of your superconductor, then if you have a vortex condensate inside, you can imagine a Wilson loop around that, I guess, and would randomize the flux inside of that, right?
But there's no confinement, right? I think it may have something to do with the fact that it's non-compact gauge theory.
But so is the U1 when you can have this is the dual version now. Why isn't there a dual one?
But what do you mean by confinement, David?
For electric flux.
Okay, the Meissner effect is expulsion of vortices, exactly. And so in this insulating, one expels charged excitations.
If I have a negative source, why don't I get an electric flux?
It's just a one-of-one interaction. There's an insulator. There's no response of the other charges. The condensate of the vortices, just like when you condense particles, you expel vortices, but you can still create vortices above a gap.
No, I expel magnetic field.
You expel vortices. Okay, you expel magnetic flux, and you expel vortices.
But why don't I expel electric flux?
Okay. If you have a space
we'll switch. Really, in some sense, we don't have electric and magnetic fields here. We could just be dealing with neutral vortices. Even four atoms. Maybe that's a little better to think of it that way, right?
Vortices have logarithmic interaction when the bosons are condensed, but it isn't the other way around.
No, and it isn't the other way around because there's a different, because these are the gauge field here, right, which screens out the...
The vorticity is not magnetic.
How do the vortices couple to the magnetism?
Yeah.
I guess they're...
I think they might be neutral.
They're electrically neutral.
They're electrically neutral.
These have magnetic... What?
They're electrically neutral.
Yeah, electric plus one dimensions, you don't have magnetic charges.
Yeah. Don't have any what?
Sorry? You're in 2+1 dimensions, so you don't have magnetic charges.
Right. So your magnetic flux is not in the system, your magnetic flux is going out there.
It's exactly, sure.
The system is a plane,
There's a plane and these are points, okay.
But the magnetic flux is not in the system, it goes out.
I mean, in fact, there really isn't any magnetic flux. I mean, we don't... But these point-like vortex excitations... David, the theory I'm starting with is U1, for global U1 of bosons. That's it. There's no gauge. Just a second. Just take global U1 relativistic. If I want, make it relativistic, of just a global U1, a scalar, complex scalar. that we know can have a gap. I mean, the particles can be massive. That's the insulating phase. I can rewrite that in terms of these vortex degrees of freedom. I mean, in order to describe the phase in which these particles are gapped, I condense these vortices. That's it. And I get back the physics of the fact that
they're not being confining because the
original theory is not. I mean, so it's okay.
I mean, I suppose if you had really two-dimensional electromagnetism, the electric charges would have log interactions and would be as confining as the vortices are in two-dimensional.
Yeah, if one had, then it would actually be self-dual. Probably.
What wants to happen would happen exactly in a three-dimensional system if you're condensed, maybe monopolized.
It might be, yeah.
You're working in a three-plus-one-dimensional world with two-dimensional.
Yeah. But if I wanted to work, let me go into three-plus-one. What I'm going to be condensing there are vortex loops, strings, not monopoles, okay? Right, so if I was dealing with 3+1, which I can think about bosons, in a...
That is normally a picture. Some people argue that's a picture for them.
Yeah.
Condensing the vortex...
A little of that. Yeah.
Okay.
That is a picture of a confinement.
It's an incorrect picture in this case. Because one has a theory, which is trivial, in the boson, it's just a complex scalar with no gauge field, then it's massive particles. But that's it, there's no confinement or anything. And one's just doing a dual transformation, rewriting in terms of new degrees of freedom. Okay. And if I want to describe the massive phase of this U1 scalar rather than the condensed phase, one has to condense these dual variables.
That's because you've chosen the dual variables not to be
banging them on. Exactly. I've chosen to be vortices in 2+1 dimensions, which are point, and if I was doing this in 3+1, I would take them as vortex loops in 3 spatial dimensions, and then, okay, they'd have world sheets or whatever, and...
These are vortices of the statistical Z2 gauge,
No, in fact, these are electromagnetic vortices.
They really are.
Yeah.
No, they are vortices.
Yeah.
If vortex loops confine, that produces... I mean, if vortex loops condense, that must produce confinement.
Well, it must... Sorry, that's not correct. It doesn't have to. I can give you a counterexample right here. Okay.
First argument by Tuftov in 2+1 dimensions.
Okay, I don't know the particle physics literature, but I understand this simple duality.
If you were living in a purely 2+1 dimensional world, and you were to repeat the same game, you'd be creating a confined.
Well, actually, even then, I think what Leon says is right: is that the electric charges would have a logarithmic interaction between them. In fact, that would be the. What's that called? And that's a phase where the photon's massless, right? I mean, that's a Coulomb phase, right? That's a Coulomb phase.
So you don't condense the monopole?
I don't have monopoles, okay? I'm not condensing them. It's, I guess particle physicists don't like vortices either, apparently. Stuck on monopoles, go to vortices, It's a different.
The 2+1 monopole is the 2+1 vortex.
Fine.
So you condense the exactly same object. It's the.
Okay.
Thank you. There should be a limit in which case it's sort of the speed of light to infinity, and magnetic fields become non-magnetic fields.
I don't have a dynamical magnetic fields at all. Yeah, no. We'll take a speed of light to infinity.
Condensing and be non-magnetic.
What's that?
In some sense, all this should be close to the C equals infinity limit.
Yeah, let me be in the C equals infinity limit.
So then what does it mean for magnetic
something? Vortices could exist in a system with no charge.
But
let's take a two-dimensional...
Non-dynamical.
What's that?
The magnetic field is non-dynamical.
The magnetic field is non-dynamical, but there are still vortices. Right? Take helium-4 superfluid film. There's no electric charges in the system at all. It's just neutral, electrically neutral bosons. They condense, and there are point-like vortex excitations. They don't quantize the external magnetic field in that case, of course. But the circulation is quantized, right? So then maybe that's what's misleading, is I'm calling this magnetic flux rather than just measuring the circulation. I mean, this is a way to tell you how big the circulation is in these vortices, that if I turned on a... If I gave the boson that condensed an electric charge, and this would be the size of the flux that would be the magnetic flux, which would be quantized by that vortex. I mean, inside a superconductor, in fact, one has, there's a vortex core, and then there's this, typically in an extreme type 2 superconductor, then there's this huge, big flux tube, and so there's you know, the vortices and the flux are just different things, right? But let me, okay, so since on this point we really got caught up, let me just say two seconds, I'm going to move to how to detect just to wrap up, but let me say where the Z2 is coming from. There's a global Z2 and there's a gauge Z2. Some of you know the 2+1-dimensional pure Z2 gauge theory is dual to the 2+1-dimensional global Z2 Ising model. Okay, so if I'm working in terms of vortices, there's a global conserved circulation. I pair vortices and condense, and so I leave uncondensed a global Z2. And when I break a vortex pair apart and create unpaired vortices, I cannot really label their quantum numbers by a U1 circulation. I can just label it by a Z2 circulation. So those are the visons, right? And they carry the global Z2, conserved Z2 charge. Right? If you put two of them on top of each other, they disappear. But I can, if I choose, I can work in a... If I don't want to work with vortices and I want to go back to the particles directly, just what I can do is I can formally rewrite the electron operator as a product of an operator which creates a spin-carrying excitation and the charge-carrying excitation. And let me just do this on a lattice, just to, you know, regularize in the ultraviolet somewhat carefully. Then when I do this, when I make a change of variables, I go from this operator and I rewrite the Hamiltonian in terms of these two operators, I introduce a local Z2 gauge symmetry. And that gauge symmetry is I can change the sign of these two operators locally, and I'm even varying the electron operator.
Why isn't it that you want to create
an entire... You can, but you don't need to. That's just...
I have a bigger...
I know.
What?
But it's a redundancy, and you're building in more redundancy than is necessary, right?
No, it's just a property.
No, it's not, because, okay, it depends on what comes in the Hamiltonian, right? I'm going to rewrite the Hamiltonian in terms of these variables, and there can be terms in the Hamiltonian which look like... Right, which don't have a conserved internal U1.
But are those terms...
Those terms are allowed. When I make this change of variables, those terms are there. Right? If I start with a general...
If you don't want to preserve the U1 symmetry.
A U1 gauge symmetry, it's not golden. I mean, the only physical symmetry is... Yeah.
Sorry, if I start with the Hamiltonian, right?
Yep.
Presumably it contains only Cs.
Yep, and it has electromagnetic U1.
Don't you
think
over
C's?
Because then you
build
his interaction there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So.
Where does that interaction correspond?
Okay. There's a way. And what I actually do is introduce a pair field, and so okay, the actual step here is I start with Hamiltonian in terms of C's, and I introduce a Cooper pair field. Let me call it delta, which is a complex field, which carries charge 2E and spin 0. Okay, and I can do that with a Hubbard-Chertanovich transformation and, you know, decoupling some interaction term. And that's what one does in BCS theory, but I'm going to do that and keep a local quantum field. So this is, in some sense, a local Cooper pair field, right? But it's not a Cooper pair, it's condensed. And then the loud term in Hamiltonian, you know, is...
So that
one's
gauge invariant under the
U1. Yeah, and so then what I do is then basically one writes delta. Let's see, what does one do here? Yeah, and then basically one writes delta is B squared. Right? So one introduces a boson operator, this charge on which is half the Cooper pair. Right? And so this becomes and the electron operator is, you know, basically electron operator is okay, maybe, yeah, this would be B dagger, B dagger.
Like, condensing terms of the U1, you've chosen a gauge.
You know, he made a choice. Well,
a global U1. I mean,
if he said the rules are very fluid, he could have written, you could have written delta equal to B cubed.
I know, but the reason actually, if I wrote delta as B squared, it, right. In part, was because...
So,
Well, or the B. I mean,
okay.
But if I define the C's as B's, okay, then this thing I can rewrite. When I take this theory in terms of delta and delta star and C dagger, I can rewrite. I write delta as B squared, and I write the electron operator as F times B, and I rewrite everything in terms of F and B. So I get a Hamiltonian in terms of the F's and B's. And there's going to be a term in this term in the Hamiltonian becomes just F up, F down. Plus emission conjugate. Okay, so
Looks like what's happening is delta, which carries charge 2 under the symmetry, is condensing and breaking at 2.
No, it's not condensing. I'm just making a change of variables. I'm not condensing anything. I'm introducing a field. What I'm doing, though, is I'm breaking the Cooper pair into two pieces. Right? I'm taking the square root of the Cooper pair operator, basically. Well, how do you understand that? Well, when you do that, you introduce this Z2 gauge symmetry, and you need a gauge field to make sure you sort of project back into the physical Hilbert space. Or you can go in terms of vortices and pair of vortices.
Why do you do that? Why do you think like that they call this thing?
What kind of answer do you want to that? I mean, why do you consider, CFD ADS, right? I mean, but actually, I mean, this leads to interesting, I mean, it's really phenomenologically motivated, I think, in the long run, right? I mean, it's...
So is this equation the definition of HOCC back? I mean, you say you're just doing a change of variables, you're breaking some
sentence, it really... I'm not... Okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, I didn't even want to go into this. I didn't want to go into these technical details, but if you insist, I start with an interacting electron system, just built in terms of the C's, and there are quartic terms in the Hamiltonian. I decouple one set of those quartic terms, introducing a charge 2 spin 0 field, okay? But I don't integrate out the electrons. I integrate out some high energy set of electrons, and I then develop a quantum field theory, local, which involves the electron degrees of freedom and a local Cooper pair field, okay? Charge 2 spin 0, and this is charge 1 spin 1/2. And then I write down basically all terms allowed by electromagnetic symmetry, the U1, electric charge conservation, and spin rotational invariance. And one such term is this one. I mean, that's, okay. And then I make a change of variables where I basically take delta and write it as B squared, and I take C and I write it as F times B. And then you can see there's a Z2 symmetry here. If I can change the sign of B, delta's invariant. If I change the sign of both F and B, then C better be invariant, right?
And that change of variables was designed to help you describe a particular kind of phase.
Exactly.
It's
yeah.
Not a.
I mean, the fractionalized phase that the particular fractionalized phase we're describing has Z2 vortices ultimately. So. At this level, I'm just putting in by hand. I'm trying to get, start with the system interacting electrons, and by hook or by crook, go into an effective field theory for an interesting fractionalized phase. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm not trying to, show that, I'm not trying to solve the interacting electron problem, directly. I mean, of course, I'd like to do that.
Is there in some way a principle of writing B and F in terms of C?
The principle.
As some
collector
statement.
No, I mean, I think...
There are cases where you can write quarks in terms of it.
Yeah, well, I think it's extremely non-local.
Yeah.
But, okay, so... In 1 plus 1 dimensions, one has, the fractional particles are solitons. In 2 plus 1 dimensions, the analog of a soliton is a vortex. I mean, at least that's what I would like to say. And then we have to use those, I believe, to really understand what's going on. But 2 plus 1 dimensional fractionalization is, qualitatively different than in 1 plus 1 dimensions. And that's... let me just very briefly mention how we might detect or rule out that this is going on in the coupe rates, and that's to, I mean, we mentioned that, I guess, in a superconductor, vorticity is expelled, right? Vortices are expelled, and so in a superconductor, if one makes a superconductor with this geometry, the magnetic field and the vortices are expelled when one goes into the superconducting phase, but one can get trapped with, let's say, a magnetic flux of HC over 2E, for example, through the bore of the superconducting material. So this is where it's superconducting. Okay, the essence of a fractionalized insulator. So I'll take the same, same geometry, but now in a sample where this is an insulator of this funny kind. Okay, it's a fractionalized insulator, and the important thing about this fractionalized insulator, because I was in two dimensions, maybe I should just draw it in two dimensions, but this expels these Vison excitations. But we can get a situation where a Vison is trapped through the bore of a cylinder. Now, how would one know whether there was a Vison there? Well, one would have to take one of the particles that carry the Z2 charge and realize that, well, I'd try to drag them around the hole, and their wave function would change sign, right? So, but we can't really get our hands directly on one of these excitations. But what we can do is we can start in a phase which we hope is fractionalized, a fractionalized insulator, and we can maybe dope or cool, do something to derive this into a superconductor where we condense the boson, the charge E boson. And what happens is, as we already argued, that if one has a Vison through the hole of the cylinder, then these charge E bosons have anti-periodic boundary conditions, so that when they condense, we necessarily nucleate a flux. In fact, we spontaneously break time-reverse invariance and nucleate a flux, which is plus or minus HC over 2E, magnetic flux. On the other hand, if we could prepare the system without a Vison, then the boundary conditions for the boson is periodic, and when we condense it, we wouldn't choose to put in currents, right? I mean, so we'd then go into a superconducting state in which we have no spontaneously generated flux. Okay. So this is the suggestion by Centaur, the former postdoc here, to try to, in fact, tune back and forth between the superconductor and the pseudo-gap regime. I mean, in the ideal experiment, would be tuning back and forth between the superconductor and this insulating regime over here. And one could, for example, the suggestion was the following. You start in the superconductor with H over 2E flux present. You move into the insulator, and if it's a fractionalized insulator, the Vison, which is really in some sense part of this H over 2E vortex, is then sitting trapped in the hole. But the magnetic field is no longer expelled from this material. And in particular, you can turn off the magnetic field. So we have now no magnetic field present. But if this is fractionalized, this Vison is trapped there. And then you tell whether it's trapped or not by just going back into the superconductor, and then you look for a spontaneous generation of H over 2E flux. And that's a brilliant suggestion. It's too brilliant. Because I think it's going to, it's being done, and it's at this stage, the results are not positive. I guess that's very different than negative, isn't it?
I don't know, maybe this is just a matter of semantics. But it seems to me that when you have flux lines through the hole, the flux line really exists, right? In the sense of, like, put a magnetic particle,
yeah.
You feel the effect.
Yeah.
But the Vison, when you draw the dotted line, it really is.
I know, so you're exactly right, Tony. So what one should think about is turn off the electric charge of the Cooper pairs. One can then have one can still have a circulating current, mm-hmm. right? But it wouldn't have, there would be no associated magnetic field. And that's the situation one has in the Vison. I mean, there isn't really a physical object there.
Right.
It's just, I'm drawing that to encapsulate the fact that there's an anti-periodic boundary conditions when one takes this charging particle around. But how can you do that? Because, well, that's the thing, is we can knock an electron out
right.
of the system, but we don't know how to knock a B or an F out. I mean, because our vacuum is not interesting enough. We only have electrons. It's the this is a terrible little picture. Anyway, but you can't even see it. But this is actually a 10 by 10 micron a single crystal of yttrium dioxide, copper oxygen in particular, one with a very low transition temperature. And this experiment, basically, you know, sort of the first version of this experiment has been done. And what, I mean, you know, you hope, well, I was hoping that they would, you know, find an effect, a positive effect. Right, so you might have gotten lucky and actually seen an effect, the spontaneous generation of flux. So that would be hard to explain in any other way. Okay, now what's happened is they haven't seen it, and so then what they can do is put bounds on the energy gap of the Vison. Because you, so the thing is, you're sitting here at finite temperature with this, let's say, with this Vison trapped, and even if you're in a fractionalized insulator, this Vison can thermally excite out of the hole and get out of the sample. And so you have to really, you would have to then heat and cool the sample quickly enough that you don't have time to thermally activate and lose the...
You heat it in order
to stop here. Okay, so you heat it, unfortunately you heat it to go out of the superconductor. Now, I mean, the ideal experiment would be you take it at, you know, millikelvin, and you, well, you with a gate or something, and now that's, it's imaginable. I mean, one could imagine doing something like that, something hard. But what has been done so far, you're sitting here with a TC of 10 Kelvin, you're going up and down. And so you have to go up to about 15 Kelvin to be well out of the superconductor. And then, you know, you can thermally activate, you know, if this is the Vison gap. And, you know, this is the rate at which the Vison can escape. And so what they've basically done is put an upper bound on the Vison gap. And, I mean, you know, the number is around 350 Kelvin for this particular crystal.
Where's your expect?
Well, one might have expected it to be comparable to this. One would like to think that as one goes more under dope, this energy for the Vison would actually be increasing, right? So, but you know, how quickly, and but this does, you know, this is a slightly discouragingly small energy scale, so that brings me to my last point: is when does it occur? Well, I think experiments like this, which are going to be refined, will, you know, one can never definitively rule out something like this, but at best one could say there's some sort of low energy fractionalization going on, and maybe one doesn't have to care about it, even if it's there.
So in that experiment, has people done the same up and down temperature range in overdoped region? Do you have any of the superconducting?
No, anything? They haven't, but I mean, it's... Well, it's not seeing anything surprising at all, right? I mean, you just go up and the flux gets out and you come down, there's no flux there.
No, right?
Yeah, no, one could do that. And, one doesn't expect anything. And, but, you know, I'm just saying, people probably haven't done that. This suggestion was only, you know, 9 months ago that Centaur made this suggestion. So there's only, you know, there's two experimental groups that have honed in on the interesting region and trying to look there. So they just haven't bothered doing an experiment in other materials. What's that, sorry?
People see
HC over 2E, trapped in a superconducting hole, for sure.
This one will distinguish it for ordinary
superconductor? No, in fact, an ordinary superconductor has an HC over 2E flux quantum, and...
So, can many people, what is the distinguishing feature?
Well, the distinguishing feature is that we're interested in the non-superconducting phase over here, which nevertheless has some trapped vortex, or if you will, you know, right, this Vison is trapped in this insulator. It's not an electromagnetic vortex. So I think in the Coupe plates, well, we'll also have to wait and see. And there are a number of other systems which I think are potential candidates for seeing fractionalization. I think actually one of the best might be, really based on sort of theoretical reasoning, is the two-dimensional metal insulator transition in silicon MOSFETs. I mean, silicon MOSFET is the basic element of a MOSFET transistor. What makes these two-dimensional electron gases, they can be at very, very low densities, where the Coulomb interactions are huge, I mean, they're incredibly strong, and there's interesting ring exchange processes going on and so forth. So there are other systems of frustrated quantum magnets, and that, you know, historically people have been looking in those systems for fractionalization. There's solid helium-3, particularly solid helium-3 films, where there's no charge. It's not spin-charge separation. If it occurs, it would be spin-atom separation. Right, so you'd have a helium-3 atom moving around without any spin. Well, I mean, it wouldn't be an atom, right? But, you know, it's, and, Okay, but, so then on the theoretical side, I mean, where we're at is really with the level of effective field theories, right? So we can, you know, write down effective field theory, and we more or less know how to connect the degrees of freedom with the original, you know, effective field theory, and then with the electrons, I mean, the Hubbard-type model and so forth. We know loosely how to go from one to the other. What we have not been able to do, although I think, you know, it's starting to make some progress on that, is to start with a Hamiltonian built on a lattice with degrees of freedom, let's say the electron operators, and show by hook or by crook that under some circumstances you go into an exotic state with fractional quantum numbers, right? Now, we've been working with effective field theories essentially in which the degrees of freedom we're using are those that create the fractional quanta. Right, roughly speaking. Well, okay, so the signal for that is it's actually very hard to tell theoretically. And the way you can, the best way to tell is to look for trapping of Vison. So if you, in particular, if you put, for example, the model on a torus, a two-torus, you would expect, if you're in a fractionalized insulator, you'd expect a four-fold ground state degeneracy, at least when the system is not too small, because you can either have a Vison or no Vison between, in the two holes in the torus. Now, I mean, just very recently with Leon and Steve Groven, we've been playing around with a bunch of, you know, toy models in which can be constructed so that they in fact we can write down exact ground state wave functions and we tune special, you know, to special parameter. And we can construct exact excited states. And actually, at this stage, they're not. These are models of just bosons hopping on a lattice, and we're trying to, you know, start with a model of bosons hopping on a lattice and have the system go into a state in which the excitations have half a boson, right? And that's sort of the simplest thing one could try to do. You know, just have a single conserved U1, global U1, just bosons on a lattice, have them go into, you know, with interactions such that they go into a state in which there are excitations which have, which are bosonic but have the charge one half. That's really what we'd like to, you know, we'd like to be able to do that, and for a number of reasons, to convince ourselves that it you know, some principle can happen, but also to try to see what types of terms in the Hamiltonian can drive one into that type of phase, into these fractionalized phases. And we are getting, you know, we have some hints as to what type of terms, you know, will help push one into these exotic phases, but I don't think we really understand enough about it at this stage to really.
What
would that
gauge your boson
with the
U1 gauge
coupling?
I'm sure it's
small. What happened when the boson splits? What happens to the gauge? Well, I need to carry half that charge. I mean, yeah. Sure. Yeah. Sorry to run over, but thanks for all the good questions. I mean, it's great.